Welcome to Get Yourself Optimized, a podcast full of secret knowledge that will enable you to reboot and 10X your life. I'm your host, Stefan Spencer, author, speaker, online marketer, serial entrepreneur, coach, and a real geek when it comes to biohacking, life hacking, and lifestyle design.
Welcome to episode number 242. The show notes, including the transcript and checklist to this episode, are getyourselfoptimized.com/242. As we experience this global pandemic, we're not only trying to navigate a very real health threat, but we and the entire world are trying to process something very big and very scary. We find ourselves wading into waters we've definitely never imagined ourselves going into before. Today, you're going to learn about a tool called the Wise Advocate that's going to be invaluable in processing all this. My guests are Dr. Jeff Schwartz and Josie Thompson, co-authors of the book, The Wise Advocate. Jeff and Josie are both leading authorities in coaching and neuroscience. Their methodology provides new techniques for taking control of your brain, changing bad habits, and ending unhealthy thinking. In this episode, we talk about this powerful work and its applications to different situations, including, of course, coping with the COVID-19 epidemic and the economic downturn. We talk about mindfulness in general, taking control over negative thinking, negative self-talk, and deceptive brain messages to make way for increased productivity, confidence, performance, and happiness. And we talk about the connection between cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, and the work that Josie and Jeff do, which I think you'll find really intriguing and incredibly helpful. So without any further ado, on with the show. Jeff and Josie, it's so great to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Good to be here.
So let's start by talking about, because the elephant in the room is what's going on with regards to the outbreak, and there's a lot of fear and kind of hysteria and hoarding of everything from toilet paper to everything else, including guns. So what would be the most important thing for our listener to bear in mind during this time of crisis?
We acknowledge up front that we're in a situation where we don't really know what's really going on. That itself is obviously an acknowledgement that makes people anxious, but at least we have to understand what we're doing and modulate it in that context, because we're also gaining information rapidly. So one of the things that you want to consult your wise advocate about is your inner loving guide. We use it as sort of a synonym type term for mindfulness, with the added ingredient, mindfulness being basically observation, clear-minded observation of your conscious experience. In the tradition that mindfulness comes out of, that is always done for the purpose of clear-mindedly assessing and making discernments about your content and responses to the feelings and thoughts that you're having, specifically within a traditional perspective out of which mindfulness comes, about the wholesome or unwholesome nature of the content and your responses. Now, I would say in a more current usage that's come into fashion and very wide usefulness in this generation, in the last, certainly in the last 10 years, very, very intensively in the last 5 years, they put a very strong stress on a calmness and then the in the present moment, and then this word non-judgmental, which I'm kind of relieved to say isn't quite as fashionable as it was a couple of years ago, but is still quite fashionable. Mm-hmm. So when you're in a situation that's fear-provoking, because, I mean, being in an unknown situation with a disease involved is clearly going to be anxiety-provoking, fear-provoking. But on the other hand, when we're learning rapidly what's, you know, we're getting more information. So in the perspective of the four steps, which we'll say more about in this interview, which are relabel, reframe, refocus, revalue, and then the wise advocate is always working with you, your inner loving guide, in the service of doing that action of, you know, putting a clear-minded label on the contents, reframing it so that it's true. So we really want to recognize cognitive distortions. The second step of reframe is very related to what's called cognitive therapy. And there's now very much a mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is in wide use in psychotherapy practice. And then you refocus your attention based on an insightful understanding of what's happening. So these are all mental actions in the service of being clear-minded. And now we're in a situation where there's a lot, obviously, everything on the internet, on television, et cetera, a lot of experts, a lot of information, and you want to be able to take that in a clear-minded way and adjust how you focus your attention and then the value that you put on your responses and making assessments and discernments. It's favorable to our understanding of the wise advocate perspective on the practice of mindfulness because it shows how this term non-judgmental can become problematic when you're really having to make real decisions about how to apply your mindfulness, how to apply your wise advocate perspective in the real world in day-to-day living. So that's why we like to use the concept that the wise advocate helps you use mindfulness to bridge between non-judgmental and judgmental in the very specific sense of making assessments and discernments about what you're thinking, how you're feeling, and what to do about it. The big point is the non-judgmental part, which we're going to, you know, bridge to the assessments and discernments, is we certainly don't want to be in a sense of denial. We don't want to sort of like make believe nothing's happening or understate it or even kid ourselves about how anxious and fear-provoking it is. So in that way, the big point about non-judgmental from the way we practice, which is very much aligned with the traditional origins of what mindfulness is you're definitely aware. You're not filtering. You're not denying. You are receptive. You are accepting, to use a word that really does have a lot of good application. A longtime colleague of mine, David Creswell at Carnegie Mellon University, has done a lot of work in recent years on what he calls monitoring and acceptance approach to mindfulness. So you're monitoring with an acceptance of what is coming in. You want to perceive the reality. I mean, you do want to experience what's really there. But then you want to also be very aware of how you're responding to that. Because in the responding to that comes a lot of the negative emotion, negative self-statements, fear, denigration, etc. And so that's where making clear-minded assessments and discernments is so important. And then that opens you up to taking in sort of information, social distancing. I mean, it takes a lot of mindfulness to overcome the habits in a sort of polite, civil way, maintaining a 6 feet distance between you and other people, not obviously not just shaking their hand. I mean, we're in a period now where our automatic habitual responses are maladaptive. I mean, that really brings up a useful application, definitely, of mindfulness, but again, within this perspective of the wise advocate, of having that inner loving guide helping you make assessments and discernments so that you have awareness, accepting the situation that is really there, but then also being aware of what your responses are, and therefore using relabeling, like, okay, we have to respond knowing that social distancing is what is called for now. So there's a person, oh, I was about to just put my hand on their back or shake their, nope, that's not for right now. You do an elbow bump, you do what now is the appropriate behavior. And in this way, you're reframing the situation adaptively and refocusing your attention appropriately. And that's going to lead to you revaluing your situation. And then I'll just finish this kind of opening contextualization by saying, and step four, the revaluing is really an indication that a term I coined years ago, self-directed neuroplasticity, that your brain is actually changing in response to you using mindfulness and using the Wise Advocate. There's now a very significant body of research about how using mindfulness can, in fact, change your own brain. I coined this term years ago of self-directed neuroplasticity. Attention can change the brain. How you choose to focus your attention actually changes how your brain works. And so pretty quickly, when you do it in this context, you can pick up these new habits and you can change how you value the situation and therefore make new habits of responding appropriately. So that's sort of an overview of how to fit a Wise Advocate perspective into our current circumstance.
Oh, that's great. And Josie, what would you add to what Jeff just said in terms of using those four steps to address your anxiety, fear, or uncertainty? Actually, I'll give you a specific example that just happened. This is very fresh. It's like 2 hours old. Somebody was casing our house. Somebody very suspicious looking. He was going from house to house. He actually looked at our windows and he made a call on his phone. He was writing something down. He was marking our house. Very terrifying. I didn't see it. My wife, Orion, did, and she went outside, and he had already left. He was gone. She couldn't see him, really, but she saw him from the window, and he didn't know that she saw him from the window. She was recording her own podcast interview, and she noticed him checking out our place. So, pretty terrifying. She's still shaken up about that. I'm shaken up about that. We're wondering, well, do we have... like, how are we going to protect ourselves? We got a home security system, but that's not protection. That's just a big noisemaker that will happen when they break in. So that's pretty terrifying and unsettling situation that we're having to deal with now. And so now, if we use the four steps, the relabel, reframe, refocus, and revalue, how do we apply that to my situation?
Jeff, do you want me to answer, or are you happy to do
that? Yeah, you answer, because I mean, I'm sure we come up with about the same. I mean, you just actually kind of relabeled it there pretty good. So now with it, you know, you kind of relabeled it. And now, okay, so now we start reframing. Obviously, this is certainly not an example of where you're going, that's a deceptive brain message. I mean, this is really one of those complex situations where you have to really use assessment and discernment. It is a good example of saying, I'm sure you wouldn't want some pop mindfulness teacher to now tell you to just be non-judgmental.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now you're in the tough job of needing a Wise Advocate perspective to make appropriate assessments and discernments.
And the way to do that is to notice that initially your brain will be focusing on the threat of the situation, which is what the brain's designed to do, right? We're designed to be looking out for threats in our environment, with the overarching intention of keeping us safe. Now, clearly that was a situation that created a threat response, and naturally then it elicits emotions that really seize your capacity to think straight. So this is where applied mindfulness is really, really key, to really settle down those compulsions and those potential reactions that you might then enact if you're not being mindful. So the first thing you need to do is literally what my kids tell me to do from time to time is calm my farm, really settle down your mind, your body, your breathing, your nervous system, so that you can regain that clarity of mind so you can discern wise adaptive strategies to deal with the situation.
Right, because you'll end up reacting versus responding if you're coming from this very fearful fight or flight sort of place. Yeah.
Exactly. And when that's triggered, your cognitive capacity to think adaptively and resourcefully is impaired. So what you'll notice is that your thinking is, I don't want to be robbed. I don't want to be threatened. I don't want this person to come back. You're focusing on all the things that you don't want. What we need to do is refocus attention forward towards what you do want. So what you do want all of a sudden elicits that prefrontal cortex and your capacity to now employ different thinking that has you much more solutions focused and able to just think about adaptively what do I need to do? What one thing can I do right now to feel more safe or to secure my home or to ensure the well-being of my family? Mm-hmm. What would you add to that, Jeff?
You're saying, you know, your wife was in the middle of doing a podcast. But I mean, if you can see how, if you're really, especially in this day and age with just at your phone, you can immediately take a picture. Probably could have taken a picture of this person.
She wishes she had the foresight to do that, but she was kind of in shock. And so, yeah, she didn't get a picture.
But that's almost a perfect example of what we're saying. I'm certainly in no way criticizing for being in shock, because that is the absolute natural response. But that nervous system freezing is, as Joseph Ledoux, a colleague, has written so much about over the years from NYU, that's a primary amygdala response, a physiologic response to threat, is that freezing.
Yeah, actually, that's a great point, because most people think of it only as fight or flight. But it's actually three things: fight, flight, or freeze.
And freeze comes even before the flight generally.
I think there's more. There's more than that.
Yeah, no, and of course there's more complex. But then the fear is kind of a conscious response to those feelings, and then you manage that, and okay, and you can see how clear-mindedness could rapidly enter the picture when you have, etc. I mean, just calling the police is probably going to yield you the response, we can't do anything unless we have other information or unless something has happened. And so you have to kind of prepare yourself for that, but still might want to report the possibility to the police. I mean, but then not be surprised or disappointed when you get that response. And I guess of all the times for it to happen, people are supposed to be spending so much more time at home right now. So it's one of the benefits of the current situation is, seems like it's not exactly prime time for people trying to sort of break in when no one's there, because mostly there are going to be there more than ever now, right at this particular moment. So that's kind of interesting. And of course, don't forget to say it could be innocent. The guy could have been lost.
No, he was checking out other houses in the neighborhood and making more notes.
Could have been a real estate. I mean, you know, obviously there are, it's not necessarily nefarious, but I'm not saying to.
Yeah, it looked pretty nefarious, and the guy did not look like a good guy.
Okay, well, now you're putting that part in. So there you have it. Obviously, you might want to call some of those neighbors and see if they saw it too, and or alert them to the fact that that this has been noticed.
I was formulating a list of things to do, to post something to nextdoor.com, let all the neighbors know that, hey, somebody was casing the neighborhood, keep a lookout. I posted a message to this WhatsApp group that I'm on. There's a bunch of guys that are part of a secret society that I'm in, and I asked them what I should do. So I did get my wits about me and started thinking through. That's my wise advocate, yeah. But I did have to pause and bring down my amygdala and calm down my amygdala and bring in the sanity and the space to think rationally, because that wasn't my immediate, like my, and my wife's first immediate reaction was, oh my God, we need a gun. We need to get a gun. Where do we get a gun? Right. So yeah, definitely want to bring in that response and not reactivity.
With everything we're talking about, I mean, that notice, I mean, I'm not saying it's merely a shorthand phrase. It's not merely a shorthand phrase, but it is, in fact, a shorthand phrase to say you consulted your wise advocate, except it has a deep meaning underneath it and a whole set of actions associated with it. It brings in the interface between relabeling, reframing, as you're describing, refocusing, taking, which tends to mean do something, do another behavior, focus your attention adaptively, which you were doing. Now you're in the process of valuing it. We're talking it over. All of this breadth and depth of acceptance, monitoring, receiving the information in, you know, an initially non-judgmental way, so you get all the information, do it in a common enough way so that, you know, you can pretty quickly overcome the natural nervous system freezing and fear responses that will occur, have them last shorter than they otherwise would without you consulting the wise advocate, and then starting to take appropriate action. And all of that just parts of, and obviously this could be built out and built out and built out further and further. We do have a whole topography where we talk about, you know, the high ground and the low ground has a place to play. We do that specifically in our business leadership applications of these ideas, but various parts of the nervous system come into play. And then we try to integrate those aspects of the nervous system. And this is what our book, The Wise Advocate, goes into significant detail about delineating and training yourself to use and apply. So consulting your wise advocate have a deep and rich associated set of understandings and actions that, you know, are summed up in those little words of consult your wise advocate.
Mm. This reminds me, your four-step process here reminds me a bit of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, where A plus B equals C in normal circumstances, where A is the activating event, B is your belief, and C is the consequence or consequences. But then if you kind of reevaluate, reprocess it, and you say, well, actually, A plus B plus D for dispute with the beliefs. So there's still that activating event. Somebody's casing our house, but what's my belief about that? Reevaluate those beliefs, dispute those beliefs, and then E is your new experience. You re-experience it differently. So that's what I've learned about CBT. Is this pretty similar?
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, on the book where we originally gave this kind of application of the method, which is my last book, which I wrote with psychiatrist Rebecca Gladding, who was a resident at UCLA at the time, and I've known her for many years, and in fact, I even wrote her medical school recommendation letter to go to UC San Francisco. In that book, which is where the wise advocate concept was originally introduced, I mean, David Burns.
What was the name of that book?
You Are Not Your Brain.
I love that title, by the way.
You Are Not Your Brain. And David Burns gave us one of our main endorsements. And of course, he is feeling good and one of the main people who work with Aaron Beck in popularizing and using what is the standard book for the cognitive therapy for depression. And then what the Wise Advocate is really trying to develop our approach to the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, a term that was actually coined by another close friend and colleague of mine, John Teasdale, at Cambridge in England. So absolutely, the Wise Advocate is deeply and historically linked to all of those things.
Yeah,
purposefully.
Yep, awesome. Anything that you want to add, Josie?
When we get triggered so intensely like that, and we have an automatic perception of it based on, you know, our previous life experience and hardwiring and beliefs, it's really important to realize that we're not tuning into the whole picture and all of the options available to us,
yeah.
That our focus and attention gets hijacked by the threat and therefore limits our capacity to broaden the lens on all of the information and the adaptive strategies we do have available to us.
Yeah, it's like tunnel vision.
Yeah, and absolutely. That's right. I mean, so Wise Advocate is very much a way to not get trapped in tunnel vision and to get yourself out of tunnel vision as quickly as possible.
Yeah, good stuff. So the Wise Advocate book is really about using that Wise Advocate and the four-step process in leadership as a business leader or as a leader of nonprofit or governmental leadership, et cetera. But this is applicable to everybody, right?
Actually, the Wise Advocate, as I just mentioned, that actually is an outgrowth of the book, You Are Not Your Brain, which is really very much more a psychotherapy self-help book for people with moderate routine kind of anxiety type problems. I mean, it goes way back years and years ago to my work with obsessive compulsive disorder, which is, you know, a very different thing and a very significant psychiatric illness. But, you know, as 20 years went by, I started to apply it to higher and higher functioning people. And now with the book, The Wise Advocate, we've kind of really very much gotten from help yourself kind of get to normal to we already very much recognize you're normal or more than just normal. And now we're really going for full-blown excellence and applying the method for how do you get to excellence from good.
Yeah. High performance.
High performance, exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious, you mentioned assessments and discernments multiple times. Is there a distinction between those two or are they pretty much the same?
Oh, no, they're not quite the same. I mean, but they're definitely related, but they're not the same. It is this process to sort of understanding. What I was trying to do there was take the traditional scriptural literature of the mindfulness tradition and translate it into more user-friendly terminology. And I just have to openly acknowledge that in this day and age, wholesome and unwholesome weren't going to really get us there. And even other translations of the scriptural language terms, which are kusala and akusala, are sometimes called skillful and unskillful. And even that wasn't quite there. So I figured if you really think about this whole issue of monitoring and really paying close attention, and first you want to make this sort of assessment of what is coming in, and then you want to have discernments about how you're responding to it. I'm not saying that the word discernment always is simply or exclusively an introspective discernment of how I'm responding to it. But what the wise advocate is particularly going to be good at is helping you realize when your assessment and your discernment are not well aligned, so that you can see what something is and make a proper assessment of it and still not be using proper discernment in the way you're responding to it. So it's this integration of being open to what's coming in. That's where the non-judgmental word is quite good. And then starting to make an assessment about it. That goes like right to the heart of the tradition of, is my response to this sort of skillful or unskillful? And what exactly is it that I'm responding to? Am I just responding to what my amygdala is doing? Or am I really bringing in higher cortical processes to sort of override what the amygdala is bringing up in terms of freezing, running away? And the discernment I like to think of as really quite a high level, like, you know, subtleties, really seeing the subtleties in what's going on and the subtleties, you know, almost like in wine tasting, they talk about the discernments of, you know, the bouquet and the aroma. And I don't want to talk like I know a lot about wine because I don't, but I'm just trying to show that being a connoisseur of your response is what I'm trying to get out here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so you're thinking about your thinking.
Well, I mean, and that's metacognition, and that is a big, we haven't even brought that one up yet, but that's kind of the entry point into what we call the higher ground. And Josie used the term a little bit earlier, applied mindfulness. Applied mindfulness is almost a synonym for metacognition and thinking about what you're thinking. And then that leads into paying attention to what you're paying attention to, which is a much more, considerably more challenging. And that's already into like real mindfulness, real wise advocate connection, when you're really paying attention to what you're paying attention to. How is this real? That's where you're really making these sophisticated, subtle discernments about how is my response to this, you know, grabbing my attention? What kind of attention am I applying? Wise advocate attention or more brainstem, limbic type attention?
Mm. And that's a great example, what you gave, Stefan, about the immediate thinking was based on thought and trying to create a sense of safety. And therefore, if you're not paying attention to what you're focusing your attention on or what you're thinking about, your decision-making would then be aligned with that desire for safety rather than what's the ultimate outcome that I want. Rather than the threat, what is it that I need to focus on?
Right. I've heard many times the phrase mindfulness meditation. I've never heard applied mindfulness as a phrase before this interview.
Well, thank you for, we'll take that as a compliment on our originality, Stefan. So
you're welcome.
Because that's exactly why we came up with the term, to try to avoid using the term meditation, which in business leadership circles is close to being maladaptive, or that's an overstatement because now it's become accepted enough that it's not maladaptive. But I mean, it's kind of a turnoff to business leaders.
Yeah, a little too woo-woo for some hard-driving CEO. Yeah, unfortunately.
Exactly. But applied mindfulness, all real-world leaders can relate to the term. It needs to have application. So we thought applied mindfulness would be a good entry on that.
Yeah, that's great. That made me think of like applied physics and...
Exactly.
Yeah, very cool. So is there a breathing exercise or...
Yes, there is.
Okay, how's that work? Can you walk us through that?
Yes.
Let's apply it.
I mean, I have been doing daily practice in a very, very traditional context for over 40 years, going on 45 years. I've been doing this for a long time. And I have a very, very, very long-standing, very, very, very consistent practice. And so I am a 15,000 hour mindfulness practitioner. Okay. So,
wow, that's impressive.
And I am also quite well versed in the scriptural foundations of it, etc.
Yeah. I have to ask you this. This just came to my mind. Do you know Alan Weiss over at USC and the founder of marketingprofs.com?
I've heard about him, but I don't actually know him. But if you want to make an introduction, we'd be happy.
Okay. He's big into mindfulness. Yeah, he's the Center for Mindfulness at USC. He's the founding teacher and director there. Yeah, he's a good guy.
Okay.
And you'd like him a lot, so you could go look him up.
So I gave a lot of thought to what's the way to make this absolutely as user-friendly as possible. And Josie and I, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I've done a series of webinars, and Josie will tell you sort of how you can sign up for those, or at her website, josiethompson.com, no P in Thompson, josiethompson.com. But the simple, I guess I'm okay in the context of everything we've been talking about with fear, managing fear, might as well just sort of do a quick intro to it, especially because you brought it up. I would not have brought it up if you didn't, but this is how we do. A lot of thought went into how to make this as user-friendly as possible and still have it be real. And this is what I came up with that we've been using for quite a few years now. And I even have a video on YouTube about it, and I'll probably make updated ones in the not too distant future. But it goes like this. The cardinal thing to pay attention to when doing mindfulness practice, applied mindfulness, you want to have an object that you're trying to pay attention to. And the very, very, very traditional object.
Yep. The breath.
Okay. It has something to do. It is the breath, but it's more specific than that. It okay. is the breath. So that is correct. Now I'm going to tell you a specific way to pay attention to your breath.
Okay.
It's these words taken completely literally. The feeling of the movement of the air. Okay. Turns out there are very deep reasons to be talking about that. And there's no time and or even probably this is not the place even to get into that depth. But it turns out that those few simple words have a lot of depth. And we generally say, which is the oldest way of doing it, is at the entrance of the nostril or around the entrance of the nostril. So what you're trying to pay attention to is a feeling of a movement caused by air as it enters and leaves your nostril when you are breathing.
Well, that's really cool. I've already started paying attention to that since you first mentioned it, and I already feel different. I feel more aware.
That you have an inbred aptitude for this. Okay, and then what I did was just develop a simple count just to get something like the timing that would absolutely happen naturally if you kind of practiced it long enough to kind of get up to 10 to 15 minutes of practice, certainly by 15 minutes to a half an hour practice. But it can take months or never for people to get up to, you know, 15 minutes to half an hour, right? So I didn't want to like leave people with that. So I actually built in a little bit of a count to sort of get you into sort of the right kind of way of accentuating the feeling and getting the timing very user-friendly for paying attention. And so that it goes like this. It's basically a two-breath set that goes like this. On the in, it's 1, 2, 3, 1. And then on the out, it's 1, 2, 3, 2. And then on the in, it's 1, 2, 3, 3. And then on the out, it's 1, 2, 3, 4 at approximately that pace, maybe a little faster than that. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, on the in. So let's just do it now because you were kind of paying attention to the feeling of the movement of the air.
Yep.
So now we'll just kind of add this count as you do it. So in, 2, 3, 1, out, 2, 3, 2, in, 2, 3, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's two breaths, and then you would just start over.
Okay.
Here's the important thing for everybody to pay attention and be aware of, whether beginner, intermediate, or advanced. This is a simple statement that is good for beginner, intermediate, and advanced. When the mind wanders, and it will wander, clearly if you're advanced, it's going to wander less often than if you're a beginner, but for everybody, it will wander. Or the quality of attention, your discernment of how much attention you're paying to the feeling of the movement of the air, you'll become aware that you're paying less attention at some moments than others. In advance, that's kind of intermediate. Those are the kinds of things you become very subtly aware of, is what's the quality of attention that's being paid. But the big point of this, it's not an exercise in just paying attention to, you know, your breath. There's a purpose to that, and that purpose is reflected in the awareness that the real goal is that when the mind wanders, you become aware that it's wandered and gently bring it back to pay attention to the next in-breath, out-breath, to the feeling of the movement of the air. So the real practice is the practice of attentional control.
Right. Or paying attention to what you're paying attention to.
Paying attention to what you're paying attention to. Exactly. There you go. Yeah. You're a natural. You're a natural.
Thank you.
So exactly that. So that's it. Mindful in this exercise. And that's why we're saying, and you're using your wise advocate. Your wise advocate is helping you and encouraging you, a helper, a comforter, an advocate, a counselor, an encourager, a strengthener, a guide. That's kind of just gently saying, oh, your mind has wandered. Just come back to the breath. So don't get into a whole long thing. You know, I can't do this. I'm no good at this, or paying. Try to let go of that and just kind of like go back to the next breath and not get ensnared in whatever the mind was wandering on to.
Yeah. It sounds like your wise advocate is the opposite of your inner critic, right?
Inner harsh critic, inner punitive critic, inner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Inner cognitive distortion critic, which we call deceptive brain messages.
Got it. Okay. Josie, do you have an example of a situation where you were able to use this process of this breathing and the paying attention to what you're paying attention to, feeling the breath coming into your nostrils and all that to great effect and maybe saved the day in some fashion?
At the moment, it's almost at the beginning of every single executive coaching session I'm walking into. People are coming in with heightened states of arousal and stress.
Yeah.
Needing to make some very, very stressful, difficult decisions and carrying the burden of the consequence of those decisions on their shoulders very heavily. And so the first thing I need to do before I can even have a coaching conversation with them is to help them calm themselves down and detach from those threatening thoughts and actually just get into a moment of inner peace and calm so that then they've got the clarity of mind to have the conversation that we need to have.
Now, for you personally, though, did you have this tool at your disposal when you were fighting cancer? So you're a two-time cancer survivor, as you have in your bio. Was this something that you already had in your toolkit?
Well, the first time I was diagnosed with cancer was in 1991. I was 24 years old, and mindfulness or meditation were foreign words to me at that time. It was not something that I was familiar with, nor was I really fully cognizant of the meaning of cancer. Mm-hmm. So my mission then was to really understand the circumstance I found myself in and to heal and get well. But in 2010, when I had my second cancer diagnosis, I was in the middle of my own neuroscience studies where, you know, I was focusing and studying a lot of other brains, and all of a sudden it was my brain on the scanner with a tumor. And when I had the surgery, after the surgery, I couldn't walk or talk properly. And it was extremely frustrating. I felt like I was trapped in this body that wasn't responding the way I wanted intentionally for it to do. And so I remember one day, and at this time I'd met Jeff, I'd learned a lot about mindfulness, and I remember sitting out on the grass out the back of my house, and I closed my eyes and I stopped fighting, you know, I stopped resisting the circumstance, and I just let go and I started focusing on my breath, and I did it without even thinking about it. And then all of a sudden, I still remember the moment, I opened my eyes and I started looking at the trees and the leaves and the blades of grass in a whole new way. It was like I was high on something. I've never taken drugs, so I wouldn't know. But it felt like I was just intoxicated by what I was seeing almost for the first time. These things were always there, but I'd never actually paid attention to them.
Wow.
And, yeah, from that moment, I decided that I would engage in meditation practice every day. So I haven't sustained it as long as Jeff. Mine's only been going since 2010, but I meditate every single day. And I try to make my way of life very mindful. No matter where I am, I'm trying to apply my full focus of attention in what I'm doing.
Wow, that's beautiful. And how long do you meditate for each day?
It varies every morning. I'm in front of my little, I guess I'll call it a little temple that I sit in front of for about half an hour. And then every evening for about the same time.
Okay. That's a commitment. That's amazing. And when you described that experience, I feel very connected to that kind of experience because I had something similar happen to me. I was in India. I was touched by a monk. He gave what was called a Deeksha, it's a D-E-E-K-S-H-A, which is a oneness blessing. So he touched my head with his hands, and I felt so deeply connected to the creator, to the fabric of creation, and I was agnostic, almost atheistic my whole life up until that point. So this was a very strange feeling for me, and I remember shortly after getting touched, I went straight outside. This was in Udaipur, which is beautiful, and this was a little island in Udaipur. So all these little islands have palaces on them. So we were in one of those palaces. I went outside. I remember seeing the grass and the trees and everything in a whole new way, like it was Technicolor, like a cartoon. Brilliant, the most vivid, vibrant color green I had ever seen. Mm. And I describe it to people as like it was an LSD trip, even though I've never done any drugs. I have no idea what that would be like, but it was out of this world. It was otherworldly. Amazing.
Blissful, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It changed me. It forever changed me. I'm a different person, and I feel like I'm now plugged in. I wasn't plugged into the power until 2012 when this happened.
Beautiful. I get that experience every day. Every day I do a nature walk after I do my meditation. It's the same walk every morning, but every morning I set an intention to discover something new, to see something new. And when you're doing that, you're mindful. And I'm forever awe-inspired by nature. She's just full of gifts if we would only pay attention.
Mm, for sure. It is a gift. It is such a gift. Every day that we have where we wake up and we get to breathe the air and experience things and pay attention to what we are paying attention to is an incredible gift. It's just amazing. Okay, so let's talk just for a couple minutes here. I know we're going to run short of time here, but I'd love to know, Jeff, you've mentioned the term self-directed neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to know, how do you know when you've succeeded at this, at self-directed neuroplasticity? Because I'm not going to do a brain scan and say, oh, yay, I changed my brain today.
Yeah, I love that because I do have a way of answering that says, you know, see, you don't actually need a brain scan. Now, since all the work I actually did on this was in people who have obsessive compulsive disorder, that does set a paradigm. So when the person is just processing the intrusive thought and the intrusive urge markedly differently by relabeling, knowing this is just a false brain message, reframing, I do not have to listen to this. This is not true. This is false. And then the refocusing attention is the power step, you know, the power is in the focus, that changes the brain. And then over time, you actually notice a change in the intensity of the intrusiveness, et cetera. Now, that's a very simple overview statement. And yes, there's a role for medication in it. So I just want to put that in so nobody says that I'm like some radical person about these issues. I am not a radical person about these issues. So yes, medication definitely also has a role to play when treating full-blown obsessive compulsive disorder. But when we're talking about it so that's where I discovered this concept and used the brain scans to demonstrate the reality of the brain change.
Right, right. So the way that they would be able to know, get immediate feedback, is they would have less distress when faced with, let's say, a left turn. And if they get stressed out normally and don't make left turns, they only make right turns, or they always open the microwave on a certain number.
All that kind of thing. Exactly.
So then they are like, okay, I don't need to do that. And I didn't feel distressed when I opened it at a 19 or something.
Right. So then to make it into something that anyone can relate to, because the two examples you just gave are very, very mild examples of what real OCD does. So for anyone to recognize it, remember that obsessive compulsive disorder really is generated by the habit center of the brain. And so anytime you are really, really genuinely changing a habit, you can just know that your brain is changing, right? So to change a habit does require the brain to change. If you just think about it that way and frame it that way, you'll know you don't need a brain scan. If you have changed a habit, your brain has changed.
Yeah. What's the expression? Something that wires together, fires together?
Okay. That's Hebb's law, which is a big part of our program. Cells that fire together, wire together.
There you go.
And
yep.
Yeah, no, you're really, you're good. You sure you haven't snuck in onto one of our webinars?
And the other one to think about is where focus goes, energy flows. So
yeah,
what
I like that one too.
What gets repeated gets hardwired. So whilst we can't get rid of old wiring, we can create new wiring all the time in moments of insight. When you have an insight, you are physically rewiring your brain, and then to reinforce that new behavior or new thought, you've got to repeat it, you've got to pay attention to it, and you've got to give yourself some positive reinforcement for every time you get it right.
Yeah, got to remember to reward yourself.
Preferably it's by keeping a positive notebook, not necessarily eating a piece of chocolate as the positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
Positive reinforcement can very much be keeping a notebook where you put your positive achievements in the notebook.
Yeah. Or a celebration could be just standing up and going, woohoo, I did it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. Eureka.
Yeah. Nice. I like it. I know we're running short on time here. So if there's one pearl of wisdom that you would like to share that we haven't already talked about, just a really brief one, if each of you could share one, that would be fantastic.
We've covered a lot of ground. And so, I mean, I guess I'm going to go back to like what we said at the very beginning, you know, consult your wise advocate. When I said in the beginning that there's a lot associated with that, trust me, we haven't even almost covered it all, but you can see that everything that we've done in this hour is an elaboration of the notion, consult your wise advocate. Yeah. So, you know, learn about the depth and breadth of your wise advocate and the power that comes from consulting your wise advocate.
Yeah, maybe even embrace your wise advocate.
Yes, certainly accept the input of your wise advocate to enhance your ability to make assessments and discernments.
Yeah, I love it. All right. And Josie?
Well, I would probably just reiterate what I said at the beginning, and that is that you can't control what's happening around you or to you, but you have absolute command as to how to respond. And the wise advocate is your loving inner guide that will assist you and support you and enable you to make wise discernments for adaptive strategies.
Right. Because if your happiness is dependent on the circumstances and the environment around you, you're in deep trouble.
Absolutely. Your happiness, your peace, your sense of self, this goes on.
Yeah, it's like you are a leaf blowing in the wind. And now is a very stormy time. So that would be not a good situation if you're all about the circumstances instead of you're connecting to your wise advocate.
And, you know, and I say to a lot of my clients, you are not defined by your circumstances, you're created by them.
Yeah.
And the way you need to really focus your attention is to tune into that wise advocate voice within, which is different to the one in your mind that drives you mad. The one within actually knows the right things to do. It actually can see beyond the need for expedience and look for the long-term best scenario for the greater good.
Wonderful. All right. So now, where should we send our listeners to if they want to learn more, if they want to attend your webinars, read the book, The Wise Advocate, where should we send them to?
There's an Amazon link, Stefan, which I'll send you for purchasing the book, The Wise Advocate, that's available on Amazon. You can also go to the Wise Advocate website, which is wiseadvocateadvoc8.com. and register any interest there. We're in the process of developing some resources for workplaces, probably online these days.
I'm going to repeat that website. So it's Wise Advocate with the number 8, taking the place of the A-T-E in the word advocate. So it's Wise, W-I-S-E-A-D-V-O-C, the numeral 8.com.
Got it.
The 8 takes the place of the A-T-E in the word advocate.
You also have personal websites, right? So josiethompson.com, which Jeff had mentioned earlier, where you have webinars that people can sign up for, correct?
That's correct.
Right. And my website is jeffreymschwartz.com.
Perfect. All right. So we'll have show notes for this episode with all the resources that we talked about and the links that were just mentioned. So listener, go to getyourselfoptimized.com for all that. And thank you so much, Jeff and Josie, for sharing your wisdom and your experiences and being open and vulnerable and sharing those moments that were epiphanies for you, like especially Josie, yours, where you had that kind of LSD type experience. That was fabulous.
You're welcome. Be well.
Thank you. Now I invite you to check out the show notes, transcript, action-based checklist, and all the URLs mentioned in this interview of Jeff and Josie at getyourselfoptimized.com/242.
Thanks for listening to Get Yourself Optimized. Nearly a decade ago, I started a journey that completely transformed my personal life and my business. Now I'm taking on a very select number of high-caliber coaching clients and personally helping them optimize their lives. I have limited spots, so if you're interested, go now to getyourselfoptimized.com and apply for one-on-one coaching or for our high-level mastermind. By the way, if you have any questions or comments whatsoever, email me at host@getyourselfoptimized.com. See you next week.